On this episode of the Racquetball Show podcast, we have an instructional segment on how to improve your swing mechanics. I also have on Cliff Swain, who is obviously a phenomenal player. He was 6-time number one IRT ranked player. He is also has now transitioned into coaching in his career. And I just found it phenomenal to sit down with Cliff and ask him some questions that I really wanted to ask him. And I hope you guys enjoy hearing about those things as well. Selfishly, as a player, I enjoy asking a lot of these guys who reach the top of the mountain in racquetball how I can improve my own game, essentially. And I think Cliff gives some great advice, specifically on the drive serve. That was Cliff's forte, I would say. Obviously, he was fantastic at just about every aspect of the game. But I think he was especially known for his big and powerful and accurate and dominant drive serve. So I found it great to ask about that, and Cliff didn't disappoint. He had a great answer about that, as well as I found his answers about competitiveness and some of the stories about him competing with different guys really interesting and fascinating. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy episode 20 of the Racquetball Show podcast.
It is absolute pandemonium here.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't dive for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
In today's instructional segment, I wanted to basically repeat an instructional segment that I did in a previous episode, but it's something that a few people have requested learning more about, and I just wanted to reiterate these concepts. They didn't really change, at least my opinions of them didn't change since the last time I covered this in an episode, but I felt that it was important to get into it again. So I want to talk about swing mechanics, and some people have asked me this in different ways, you know, how do I hit it harder, how do I hit it lower, how do I be more consistent with my swing, and I think this is going to address all of those concerns. So I'm a former baseball player, and there are certain variables to swing mechanics that baseball players focus on in order to improve. Baseball is a very statistics-driven game. For instance, in the book and movie Moneyball, Billy Bean, or Brad Pitt, realizes that there are certain statistics that matter much more than others. Specifically, he realized that on-base percentage and slugging percentage were two of the key stats that could best predict a player's value. Other stats just weren't as good. And as far as baseball swing mechanics go, there are key stats that matter more than others in that realm as well. While there are a million variables to a baseball swing, two matter more than the rest: swing speed and swing trajectory. You want to have a fast swing with a bat path that matches the path of the ball as closely as possible. If you can improve upon these two variables, you will vastly improve your batting abilities. We want you to think of a few variables to the racquetball swing in a similar way. What are the few keys to a racquetball swing that matter the most? If you get these few things right, you will have a dominant swing. Well, there are three keys to a great racquetball swing. It must be low, it must be flat, and it must be hard. Today we're going to break down those elements for you and help you understand how to develop great swing mechanics. This episode is going to give you a high-level look at what makes a great swing. It won't be a comprehensive look at every possible component to hitting a ball well, but it should be a good starting point that lays the foundation for what good swing mechanics should involve. For the first two keys, a low and a flat swing, they go hand in hand. Having a low, flat swing is one of the most dangerous tools a player can possess. If your swing is low and flat, you're hitting the ball in such a way that the ball has to hit the front wall low. And hitting the ball low on the front wall is the name of the game. Similar to swing trajectory in baseball, if the path of your racket is correct, you'll give yourself a much, much better chance to hit a strong shot. Another important thing to remember is that in order to hit the ball low, you must let the ball get low. That sounds obvious, but players are constantly striking the ball waist high or even chest high and sacrificing their chances of hitting a low shot in the process. You need to move your feet in order to get into a position where the ball has dropped to knee height or even lower. That means instead of striking the ball maybe chest high, you need to take maybe two or three steps back, get in position, and then hit the ball when the ball is at your knee height or even lower. To be clear, when we talk about a low flat swing, we're purely talking about the path of your racket once the ball reaches the hitting plane. Your swing can and should start higher than the location where you strike the ball. But if you make it so that once your racket is at ball height, it stays on a flat trajectory for a long distance, your margin of error is way higher. You can accidentally strike a ball a bit farther back or a bit farther forward in your swing than intended, and you're still going to hit a low shot. That's not the case if you don't have a flat trajectory. Another way to think about this is the following. Your racket should remain perpendicular to the ground throughout your swing. At any point in your swing, you should be able to freeze, and if your racket is dropped directly downward, if I were to take a screenshot or picture of you in the middle of your swing, and then we dropped your racket directly downward, the frame of the racket and the string bed of the racket should be at a 90-degree angle to the floor. Now, the final key is a hard swing. So what does that mean, and why is it important? Well, a hard swing means you're delivering more power to the ball. The racket impacts the ball at a high velocity, and therefore the ball exits at a high velocity. While it can be argued that power isn't necessary to have a great all-around game, it's undeniable that it's always better to have more power. Opponents have less time to react to your shots, pass shots move by them quicker, and they have less time to think when they're jammed. A myth about developing a hard, powerful swing is that it requires significant strength gains, or that it necessitates a decrease in accuracy. If done right, you can absolutely develop power without bulking up your body and while still being super accurate. Having power is largely about swing mechanics. Specifically, here are a few things you can do mechanically in order to increase your power. Far too often you see players, especially those with strong upper bodies, and especially men, I would say, try to muscle the ball for power. They use almost nothing but their arm. You hear a lot of people advocate for using the wrist snap as the key to power. I've seen new players focus on that wrist snap so much that they're basically just practicing that in order to improve their power. And the truth is, power is built from the ground up. It's a kinetic chain of movement from your legs, through your core, through your arm, and finally delivering the wrist snap into the ball. The wrist snap is not the driver of your power. It's really just the last link in the kinetic chain, and it basically just happens automatically by virtue of the fact that you've done all the other things right. It's not something that you need to think about and focus on. Power is generated through hip torque, weight transfer, and efficiency of movement. Players should not try to become powerful by lifting weights. Rather, spending time practicing with a focus on great mechanics will give you way more bang for your buck than focusing on muscle gain. So there you have it. If you want to have a great swing, make sure that it is flat, low, and hard. When you're practicing, reflect on each and every swing. Ask yourself, was my swing flat? Was it low? Was it hard? Break it down on video. This can be really helpful, and you can often notice things that you don't notice just when you're executing the swing. If it wasn't low, flat, and hard, why not? How could it be better? And then iterate and iterate, do it over and over again until you feel that you're getting it right. Actually, I don't think you ever are fully getting it right. I think there are incremental improvements to be made basically always. So hopefully that helps, guys. Let me know if that helps you or if you would like to know anything else about how to improve your racquetball game or how to improve your swing. I'm happy to help on this podcast. I enjoy doing these instructional segments. I wanted to take a quick moment to plug one of my sponsors, Gearbox Racquetball. Now, full disclosure, Gearbox sponsors me as a player, so of course, you know, sponsoring me on this podcast makes total sense, and I wouldn't sponsor any other brand, but I choose Gearbox for a reason. I think they're a fantastic brand. They provide top-of-the-line racquetball equipment, really anything you need, rackets, eye guards, gloves, bags, and all the other accessories that you might need. And as a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you guys already know that. You're aware of all the brands out there because probably if you're listening to this, you're pretty darn into racquetball. So I just wanted to take a moment to plug Gearbox because I think they not only provide awesome products, but they do an awesome job of promoting racquetball. And they have amazing customer service, and everyone you interact with on the Gearbox team is an awesome person. At least that's what I've found in my experience. So if you're in the market for racquetball equipment, I would advise that you check out Gearbox. You can check them out at gearboxsports.com. I am here with Cliff Swain, six-time number one IRT player, now a racquetball coach of many great players. Cliff, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Can't wait.
Yeah. So I'm really glad I have you on. I've been wanting to ask you a lot of questions. I so admire you as a player. First of all, what comes to mind, and I've played you a couple times, mostly just from seeing you play, You just seem like the most competitive person in the world. Is that true, and how did that come about?
I think I was mostly born to play sports, or I don't know how you would say it, but I can remember being a very little kid seeing pro hockey on TV. Like, I'm talking 4 or 5, that far back, that I knew I was going to play a sport. Like, that's what I was going to do. That was, I don't know. I don't think I called it for a living back then, but I just knew that that's what I was going to do. And I can also remember from being a very young kid that I really didn't like losing. I thoroughly enjoyed winning. I'm not even sure which one I like or dislike more. Probably, you know, losing has a bigger effect on me than winning. Winning feels like something that I, strived to do and accomplished it, and now I have to go make sure that I do it the next time. I'm sure there are people as competitive as me. I don't really know how they feel on the inside, yeah. But I know that the look on my face or whatever it is that I do on the court that earns me that reputation. But I also, when it got to the professional level, it was kind of pointed out to me and is clear that, some people pretend to be buddies and some people, I'm not saying that we're not buddies. And
yeah.
And I'm totally okay with not being buddies for a little bit because in a way we're really not. Like there is a pile of money, if you want to put it like that, on the table.
Yeah.
And we're both competing for it. And I hold no ill will towards anyone who uses any tactic versus me, and I hope that they don't hold any ill will towards me because it is temporary, but we are actually playing for something that affects our lives in the future. I want to bring this home to my family. And it's not that I don't want my opponent to not bring it home, but it's not like that. That's not how we do it. And the other end of it, where in my I never think of anyone as cheating against me. Like if they take a 2-bounce call, there's a referee there. And that's why they're there. And I not only do I prefer to stay out of it and let the referee doing the call, make the call and make the decision.
Yeah.
I feel like that anything else is truly unprofessional looking. Like, even though it's nice when someone gives up a call, you don't see that in any other sport. I would say with the exception of golf, right? Because, and I think the reason for that is there's so many guys out on a golf course that they've agreed to have this thing where they're going to call something on themselves because they can't, I'm not sure if that's where it came from, but they're called upon to call things on themselves. And if that was the general rule, that's how I would do it too. But it's not how we're set up to do it in racquetball. And so I prefer to let the referee make all the calls, even if I don't like them, So that was a long answer to your question.
No,
am I the most competitive person in the world? I know that I just have high, high expectations for myself. I always did every single possible thing I could do in order to get the very best out of myself. And when I didn't accomplish that, it really bothered me. And when I feel like there was lack of professionalism or care, like say by a referee, for example, you can tell when, they're out the night before or any lack of professionalism in that area is not their fault because they're not, most sports, referees will get paid and they're not to fraternize with the players and all that. And that stuff would drive me absolutely crazy. So, often it would come out as I'm mad at about a call, and sometimes that's all it was, but it's the overall lack of same concern that I have. And I understand why they wouldn't care as much as me, but I can't help that that's the way I feel. I'm out there to – oh, and another thing that really makes me feel that competitive is that I'm fully aware that when people come to watch me or whoever I'm playing play, like say at the U.S. Open, for example, these people have taken time off of work. They are spending their vacation often away from their family, spending money that is very difficult to raise, and I think they prefer to see 100% from who they're watching over people who are like chatting and, you know, proving that they're friendly and nice. And I feel like they prefer to see absolute intensity from both players.
Yeah.
And like one of my favorite things to do at the US Open, you know, back when I was playing all the time, was sit in an area prior to my match where I could hear all the people coming in and talking, like, oh, Sudsy's gonna kick his ass, or I want Cliff to win, and all this stuff. And it reminded me how much they actually care, and I could hear the buzz of the place and the feeling that they had, like what they were looking forward to. And for me to go out there and do anything less than 100% was not acceptable to myself. So I really appreciate that about the people that would, you know, come there and sit there and watch, and that's what they're doing with their free time. So I want to give them 1,000%. So
yeah, so it sounds like you take certain slights against you very seriously from what you're saying. I know that that's kind of a commonality among great athletes. I was listening to something about Michael Jordan, and he would just take little morsels of things that people said and just use them as motivation. Is that something you found yourself doing, or are there certain things that people said or certain slights against you that you just used as fire?
Absolutely. You know, when I remember like getting to be like 27, 28, and Sudsy's 20, and oh, you know, he's on his way out, he's almost 30, and I was like, that was like, if they wanted me to lose, it was like the worst thing they could do is to have me overhear that, you know, because it was something I wanted, you know, I was slightly insulted, wanted to prove them wrong, and it was giving me another challenge, you know, like, I was already thinking, like, somewhere around that age, I'd probably stop playing because I had achieved goals that I thought I wanted to achieve as a kid. So, like, you know, as you're more accomplished, it's one of the toughest things to find goals, to be as driven, you know. And then I'd hear and read things like that. And then just Sudsy himself, for example, you know, how great he was, that was a challenge. So that made me, like, not even completely get the idea out of my head that as much as I love winning and love ripping through people and collecting my prize money and going home with the trophy, I love the battle. And I don't want to lose, but if I do, I'm going home and getting right back after it, and I can't wait to do it again. So as bad as a loss is to me, it's also inspiring. So him coming along was a great thing, and then he kind of quit before I did, and I was kicking the idea around again of doing something else and spending more time at home with my family, and then along comes Kane. Even though he was almost 20 years younger than me, I was like, absolutely, let's do this. I just couldn't, even though I know it comes with possible bad times for me.
Yeah.
You know, someone who is focusing on nothing else in the world but beating me. And I'm, you know, I feel like as you age, the bigger problems come from distractions more than age itself, even if they're great distractions, family or investments or having a nice life, you know, just a fun life. You have made some money, you're comfortable, you get to go travel the world. Those are distractions. Even though positive, they can be problematic, you know. So I just made myself make sure that I still kind of acted like a hungry kid, you know, not doing too much of that other stuff, so that, because I knew what the other kid was doing. He's home training, thinking about me and watching videos or whatever the heck, just trying to make their life better at my expense. And that's how I looked at it. So that's probably where the intense look or behavior or whatever it is on my face that comes out. So
yeah, it's pretty clear playing you and just watching you, seeing that intense look. And if you've watched Cliff, I'm sure you've seen it. Just, I don't know, you look very angry and very like fired up and ready to go and very locked in.
Yeah, and honestly, it should come as a compliment to my opponents. Like, we played last night, and if I didn't have any respect for you guys or I wasn't worried about losing, you wouldn't see that look on my face at all. Or any of it. But I know that you guys are great athletes, great doubles players, and it's a huge challenge for me. I'm 53, and you guys are fit and healthy and great at it. So that's why I get intense, because I want to see what I can do, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned your rivalry with Sudsy, and that's something I'm very interested by. And I think it's so cool that you guys were not necessarily the same age, but you had basically peaks at similar times. Can you talk to me about that rivalry and what that was like for you and what the peaks and valleys of that was like?
Well, like I said, I really love the challenge. You know, I really do, but it was the first time I was playing against someone who was playing, you know, with total confidence against me and them not feeling the pressure. So Sudsy had, like, at the beginning especially, it's a no-lose situation for him. And the reason I know that is because when I was, say, playing Hogan, I have nothing to lose against him. And when you play like that and you're at the same time you're hungry and intense with nothing to lose, everything to gain, you lose but put up a good fight, you still look pretty good. And when you're in the other position like that Hogan was in, that's an everything-to-lose situation. And to most people don't play well at that point. Mm. And some do, and then overcome it. And I wanted to be one of those guys, you know, and it didn't always go well. And it's one of the things that I'm most proud about is that my career, I don't care about the stats and all that. It's the fact that this young, brash kid from New York, I mean, instantly makes me not like him, right? He's from New York and I'm from Boston. We're all rivals to a certain
probably
point,
like,
right?
The Yankees, too.
Exactly, you know? And the fact that I took my beatings and kept digging at him, and, you know, over the summer I could have said, you know, that's, hey, I've already accomplished all my goals. I've done enough. I can just, you know, walk off into the sunset, so to speak. And I chose to do it the other way, and it was the mightiest challenge I had faced, you know, and I think, you know, like the first year I lost my number one spot to him was terrible. It was an awful feeling to me, but I got it back, you know, and I think that's, as far as stats go, I don't usually pay attention to the numbers and stuff, but I do know that prior to me, Hogan, Yellen, every time they lost their number one spot, they never got it back. Mm. Really tough to deal with someone on coming up like that.
Yeah.
But then when they actually accomplish it, they're even more confident. You know, so Sudsy's, I'm sure, was thinking, you know, it's just an easy time for me to fold and an easy time for him to feel even greater about what he did and to just keep pounding on me, right? But I just really was not okay with that, and that I'm super, super happy with myself that I didn't pack it in and I did get it back. And it still didn't always go well, but it was like, on one hand, a tough thing for my career because I took a bunch of losses, right? And he was number one like five times or four times. I forget what the number is, but while I was playing, and I was number two each time.
Yeah.
So had he not been there, I guess statistically I would have five more, right?
Yeah.
But I would love to have those five, but I would rather have dealt with him and overcome a lot of those bad times with him than having actually just had the five, you know, the five easy ones or whatever. So it was great because his personality is different than mine.
Yeah.
He'd show up he'd like rent a Hummer, you know, and I don't know what I'd have, but he's just very outgoing, fun. Everyone, he'd light up a room, you know, and I was just a little more laid back and quiet and just personality difference. So the intensity of the dislike, even though it wasn't true dislike, he didn't do anything to me, you know, but the fact that he was trying to take that pile of money that I'm speaking of, and we're not talking just prize money per match, we're talking about companies that were, you know, courting us, you know, we're fighting for, at that time, you know, what adds up to be a lot of money, you know, meaning if you earn it all, you could very likely not work ever again for the rest of your life. If you don't, you know, you might have to work sooner than later. So it was very, very intense. And racquetball was huge then. And there was a lot of eyes on you. And my friends at home would ask me how I did. Or, you know, I didn't want to go home and tell them that I lost. And my parents cared immensely about how I did, and they knew what I was going through. And I didn't want to pick up the phone afterwards and tell them that I lost. So it's a lot of pressure. But I can't make light of that pressure, but at the same time, I realized it's just a game too. And that's how I found my way to play well. It's like, it's super important to me. It's intense as can be. But at the same time, I'm healthy. My family's healthy. Go out there and, you know, give it 1,000%, but you're not going to die if you lose this match. So that's how I end up playing well, is the most intense as you can be, but at the same time, it's still fun. So when I can balance those two, that's when I have good days.
Yeah, yeah, I was curious about that. I'm glad you got into it, because I find that it's hard to both be really competitive and want something a lot while not tensing up and getting over anxious due to the fact that there is a lot of pressure.
Yep, I think that just comes from practice, you know?
Yeah.
One day you finally get through one of those matches feeling a little jittery.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't handle it just right, but you did get it done. And then the more you're in that situation, the better you get at it. Just like hitting forehands or backhands. It's just a learned skill, I think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I think a lot of people view things as just fixed, right? Like Cliff is just competitive. That's the way he is.
Yeah.
And yet there's a skill to it. You can build that muscle
through
experience and through doing it over and over again.
Yeah.
I was curious, so talking about your rivalry with Sudsy, and there was this period where maybe it seems from the outside like he is this up-and-coming guy, you're kind of more on the way out, he keeps getting first, you keep getting second, and then you turn the tables.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think allowed you to do that?
Well, I remember this, I think the last tournament of the year, one year where, you know, it was already done, I wasn't going to be number one, and we played in the finals. That's like, it was just a very easy time to just, like, be defeated, feel bad for yourself, or feel great about, hey, I've done all this, I've already done great things, you know, and you just get soft and you move on. I just was not only was I not satisfied, I enjoyed the challenge. As much as I hated losing, I really, really liked it. So I remember going into that final saying, like usual, you know, but more so with this, in this case, like, I know I've been having a tough time with him lately, but this is going to be a terrible, I wanted to make it a terrible day for him, win or lose, just like he would for me. You know, like, this is, even if I lose or even if I win, I need to make every time we get on the court, which is what I tried for everyone, to make this a terrible, this is not a hit around session. Mm-hmm. This is not a mean nothing tournament, because it's the rankings over with. Like, this is a tone setter, in my opinion. Like, so you can go ahead and think about this all summer long, or you can just say to yourself, ah, I beat him all these other times, it's no big deal, but I'm not going anywhere. So I decided to not have any excuses. Like I said, I've already done this, and this tournament doesn't matter. You have to lay it on the line, kind of. You have to not build in excuses. Like, I could do everything I'm saying to you right now and give it 100%, and I could lose again, right? So then I'm not building in any excuses, right? So that can be a tough thing, but I just said, I'm going to do that. That's how I'm going to be. And it's mostly how I was anyway, but I really extra attention on this. And I won that match. And the following year, I believe, I got my number one ranking back. And I feel like, at least to me, it had a lot to do with that. You know, did that answer your question? I just, thinking about him, I'll get worked up right now. I'll go find him and go play him down the side court. And he'll play me too, by the way.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting. I think you did answer my question. I'm sort of curious about, it sounds like there's both this mutual respect and friendship, but there's also hate.
Yeah. It's because of the true fact that he's trying to take something from me and I'm trying to take something from him. And that's the truth. And I don't see that much in people on a racquetball court these days. And I think the sport suffers for it because people say it to me. I see it myself. You know, like, we miss that. We miss that intensity between you two. And it, I don't, it wasn't just us two. It was everybody across the board, I feel like, was super, super passionate. Maybe because there was more at stake at the time. Or I hear the generation thing. I don't really know, but I don't see quite enough of it. And I don't think they should fake it or anything. I don't really know, but... I just think the more intensity, the more true passion, desire to win, hate to lose, the people benefit by watching, and then the sport benefits.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you just see it less in sports in general today. I think you watch the NBA, and there used to be all these big rivalries, big, you know, hatred between guys. Now there's Twitter feuds and drama here and there, but it's mostly fairly buddy-buddy.
It's why I love the NHL. Like, you would never know that they're multimillionaires and that they are probably friends too. Lots of, I know they are. I know some of them, and I know that they're very friendly with each other. And out there, they're like, they might fight each other and then go back to being friends the next day. It's just, to me, it's the most, still the most intense live sport going. Or not just live, to me, on TV. It's a little more enjoyable live, but I can just see the passion and the intensity, and it's why I love to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the NHL. I know that you have a big hockey background, and I believe, I actually don't fully know your history in it, but I believe at one point you were considering going professional in hockey. Is that true?
Well, I always wanted to. Like I said, I always knew I was going to play a game. I was playing baseball and hockey a bunch, and I was enjoying it and having some success, and that was my plan.
Yeah.
You know, could it have gotten to there? I don't really know. I always believed it could. I just, because that's what I was going to do. And then I accidentally, or I won, you know, a pro tournament when I was young. And then I started missing an occasional baseball practice or hockey practice because there was a tournament. I thought I could do both, you know, and make everyone happy, coaches especially. And, you know, eventually they kind of made me decide. And... my dad said that, you know, after I won the first few, especially the Ekdahl Nationals, which was the biggest one.
Yeah.
That one was on ESPN, and it was right before the Lakers-Celtics game on a Sunday. So it was like millions of people watching, and the money was bigger than it is today. I thought, he said the sport is going to struggle from here on in. I don't know how he knew that, but that's what he said. And that was 1985. He's like, I think this is the peak. And... I said it was going to go the other way. And he said, go back to baseball. You will have done all this, and then you will have, you know, the same success or more. That's his opinion, you know. And, you know, I don't really care which one I played. The only thing that makes me regret not having played baseball or hockey is that the more credibility. You know, like, I enjoy playing in front of the most amount of people possible, the most amount of pressure possible. That's what's fun to me.
Yeah.
And the times that racquetball didn't provide that, you know, with not a lot of people there, or it's not even a big enough venue for a lot of people sometimes, that's what was disappointing to me. I certainly would love to have made, you know, the kind of hundreds of millions so that I could take care of my different levels of my family and donate more and all that kind of thing, but... As far as the games go, I just love them all. I love to compete. So,
yeah. Somebody told me at one point, actually, it was Jim Winterton. He told me, he was talking to me a little bit about footwork. And he's like, if you think of really the two greatest players of all time, Kane and Cliff, they both played hockey growing up, and that has contributed to them having amazing footwork. Do you feel like hockey gave you a big leg up, the background you had in it? And is it footwork, or is there more to it than that?
I'd say it's a combination of things, but the footwork for sure, because, you know, since you're on those blades, you can't really do things off balance quite as much and get away with it. Where, like, I don't know, you can do it, say, in basketball, because you're just, you're on your foot, and you're just holding a light basketball, say, just for a rough example, where in hockey, you know, being on that thin blade and trying to shoot a puck or getting hit at the same time, you know, just requires perfection a lot more.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I think hockey helped with is, you know, is the toughness. Like, there's no excuses. If you're hurt, you play. If you're not, like, injured, if you're injured, then okay, then don't play at all. And that's something my dad would say. Like, if you're injured, then you don't play. If you're playing, then you're not hurt, you're not injured. There's no gray area. It's like, don't let everyone know about it. Is you don't, like, make sure everyone knows that you have this injury so you have your built-in excuse. I can't stand that. You know, and I see it all the time where people will just let people know. I saw it when I was a kid, and I see it in pro sports. I see it in pro racquetball where, I don't know, there's a built-in excuse. And the fact is that everyone's usually a little bit banged up. And if you lose because you – or if you lose and you coincidentally had a sprained ankle, you just lost.
Yeah.
You know, you made the choice to go out there and play, which is a good choice, but there's at that point there's no excuse. And that's kind of the hockey mentality, and I'm sure that, you know, when you're in a locker room, when everyone's doing the same thing and everyone's playing hurt and no one's complaining about it and you're looking out for your teammate, and I don't know, that and the town I lived in and my dad the way he was, there's just no excuses, period. And so I'd say that's, you know, hockey and that way really helped, you know. So it's, I mean, getting hit with a racquetball at 200 miles an hour is nothing compared to, you know, getting crunched by somebody or getting hit with a puck somewhere or slashed, or none of them feel great, but you know, it's all, you can deal with it. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. And while we're on the topic of other sports, I know that you took a year off to pursue professional tennis.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that experience and how you ended up doing and why you went into that?
Yeah, it was about 2.5 years I took off. Racquetball was, you know, at its worst in the way that I kind of just mentioned. The magazine fell apart. So, you know, that credibility thing I was talking about, you know, wasn't on TV anymore. The number of tournaments was going down. I had been number one, I think, the previous year, so, and I had a decent contract, so everything was kind of okay in that area for me, but I didn't enjoy it as much because, like I said, I liked the pressure of being on as big a stage as possible. So one day I was at my club that had tennis courts. Boris Becker had just recently won Wimbledon, and he and his coach and the coach's son, Jan Tyriak, they came to the club to hit around. Tyriak and Becker were hitting. The son needed someone to hit with. I was watching. Hey, you want to hit with my son? So I went out and hit with his son on the court next to them while they're practicing. And then they took a break, and they were watching us. And I probably had only played like a dozen times in my life.
Yeah.
I just never really picked up a tennis racket much. But because of racquetball, I kind of had a clue, and I watched a lot. And Tyriak, you know, I'm putting it briefly, but basically he said, how long have you been playing? I said, it's probably my 10th time in my life. And he was surprised by that. And in a nutshell, he said, you'd get really good really fast if you had a little guidance and you played a lot. So from that point on, I basically just did. So then I, like, immediately went into a men's, I think, B tournament. I don't know. That was before they used the numbers. I think I won the B tournament. I won an A tournament. And then I think it was like the equivalent of an open. I think I, you know, started like second, third. Then I won one of those. And then I beat some Division I college guys. This is all within the year or two, maybe.
And at this point, are you still playing racquetball or had you kind of?
No, I kind of stopped
completely.
Yeah. So I think this was like early summer when that happened. So bam, there you go. Like right away, all summer long, when there was no racquetball anyway. It was our off season.
Yeah.
No outdoor, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So I just played and then just decided to do it, just to stick with it. And because I just didn't want to have that regret, because like if I just kept playing and I was number one all the time, it would have been great. But you know, I would have probably added 3 more titles. But that's not all I was after, is stats.
Yeah,
I just wanted to play in front as many people as possible, and of course make a great living doing it, and be judged, you know, like I like it when people have wanted Sudsy to win, and I like when they wanted me to win. You know, both of them were good pressure to me. So eventually I started playing. I got to the point where I could give good pros a workout, you know, but I was not consistent enough to beat them with any kind of regularity. You know, I could win games or maybe even a set. And I played a bunch of satellite tournaments. I won matches. I liked clay a lot because there was a lot of running, but the longer the rally went, the more likely I was to lose it. And that's clay, as you probably know, right? The rallies are longer just because my fundamentals, I was just learning them.
Yeah.
And my serve was probably my best weapon, so grass was better for me. The faster, the better. So eventually, for the fun of it, I played a racquetball tournament. I think like an open for some prize money. I won that. It was a pro tournament nearby. I played that and did okay. Somebody offered me, I think it was Head, offered me a really good contract. And there I was, right back in it. So it wasn't such a conscious thing to quit racquetball, and it wasn't such a conscious thing to quit tennis either and come back to racquetball. It just sort of happened.
Huh,
you know?
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned your serve being your biggest weapon, and that sounds familiar. I think that's the case in racquetball as well.
Yeah.
Could you get, for people, just give them an idea of how to hit a great drive serve, because I think if there's anybody to ask, it's Cliff Swain.
Okay, so, well, very first thing is you have to have the fundamentals of a forehand, of a good forehand, because that's what it is, a forehand. And if you're doing anything incorrect in there, you may be someone who can occasionally have a good serve or a good serving day or even a good serving week, but you're not very unlikely to be known as a dangerous server, a person who regularly wins matches because of it, and having this huge weapon that people can't overcome. So first, you have to have the forehand fundamentals. I learned those from Dave and Greg Peck. You know, I was doing it mostly correctly, I think. They made sure I was doing it exactly correctly, and they explained to me what was right and wrong. Mm. And if I missed, why? So, like, there were periods of time where I could do it and do it well enough to win lots of matches, but when I was having a bad day or a bad minute, I wouldn't know why. Dave, they explained it to me, so then I would no longer have bad streaks. I would have one bad one. I know. So now you have two serves. I hit one bad one. I know exactly what I did wrong. I adjust and boom, I could hit a second one. So because of them, I learned how to hit a great one. So past the fundamentals, then it's also what I learned from Dave and Greg is these four things, or three really. Variety. You need to have a variety, meaning you can hit all of the serves from everywhere in the box to anywhere in the back of the court. Deception is obvious, right? You need to be able to do all those things and make it look like something else. Mm-hmm. Angle, meaning you can have great variety, but if you don't hit the right angle, it doesn't really matter. Or if you're deceptive, but it's a crummy angle, you have to understand the angles and exactly how to get it exactly where, like mathematically, you know, where it's going to go. It's not by chance, because most people, even pros, when they say they're going to hit it to the backhand, I've asked them, like, so where on the front wall are you going to hit? And like, oh, well, you know, like right about here. Well, it's actually exactly somewhere. Mm. If you're hitting it from here, it is exactly somewhere on the front wall that is going to make it go exactly to a certain spot in the back court. So knowing that math is another. So variety, deception, angle, and then power. But power comes from the good mechanics of a forehand, being physically fit, being strong in all the right areas. So the mechanics of a forehand, variety, deception, angle, power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. I want to get into Kane Wozlanczyk.
Yeah.
So I think most people at this point argue that he's the greatest of all time. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. Personally, I just look at, you know, how I feel against him or anyone else.
Yeah.
And I'm 100% comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Okay, so statistically, now he's had more number ones. And if that's, if you're the type of person that goes by that, then absolutely.
Yeah.
That's not how I go about it. And, you know, not for other sports and not for myself. So, I am highly impressed by him. His skill is exceptional. There's, at this point, nothing he really can't do. You know, technically, fundamentally, forehands, backhands, serve, return. You know, he can read people. all that. So to take nothing away from him, I think he's absolutely amazing. I love watching him every time.
Yeah.
Just like I like watching Sudsy and a whole lot of other people as well. But he's an extremely gifted athlete. Love watching him play.
Yeah. So I wish we could have all had this experience, but let's say that your peaks align. So Pete Kane versus Pete Cliff.
Yeah.
How do you think that match would have gone?
Well, I think I kind of already answered that in a way, but I don't know. I beat him when you could say I was past my peak and he was there or almost there. Mm-hmm. So he was number one and I beat him, and I don't know. I think we would have had a lot of amazing matches. I think we both would have won matches and lost matches. Yeah. How the math would have come out at the end, I'm not sure, but I think the more it happened, the better it would have been for both of us and for the sport. And the same with Sudsy, if he was in there as well, like if all three of us, and then throw in a whole bunch of other great ones, you know, if we're all exactly the same age and all that, I think it would have been gruesome. I think it would have been, you know, add Menino in there, like probably the most underrated player of all the, you know, really good players, in my opinion, because he's beaten all three of us, me, Sudsy, Kane, and, you know, and with half the firepower, you know, like no power.
Yeah,
actually, and no drive serve, and I mean, he's to me. You know, if I was not in the mood, say, it'd be a very long day with him. But I could, you know, say not be in the mood against one of the other two there, and have a big serving day or whatever, and it would go okay. But you know, Jason was like just an absolute nightmare to play because he just 100% effort on every single shot, and that's I love playing him. So if all of us were playing, it would have been really, really fun to watch and probably great for the sport. But we all played each other. You know, there's it happened. You know, it's not like I was well past my prime. I know the last time I probably played or beat Cam, I was, you know, pushing 40.
Yeah,
and he was well into his 20s. You know, so. The matches went on, and, you know, he beat me and I beat him. And statistically, it's obvious, but, you know, between the two of us or between the three of us, I feel good about it.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, like when my head hits the pillow or when I sit there and think about it by myself, I'm very, very comfortable and glad I had the experience of playing both of them. It was awesome.
Yeah,
It's so awesome that I'm so ridiculous at 53. I still try to get out there. I still try to get out there and do it, even though it's only doubles right now.
Oh, but, man, you know. Well, you're still crushing it out there.
Yeah, well, there's one more. You know, next year is the 25th year. This year I gave it a few months of dedication, and this time I plan on giving it a full year of being, you know, all the way hitting more regularly and try to actually fully look, fully prepared and all that, and maybe I'll enter the singles next year. Who knows?
All right. I like it. You heard it here first.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So from all of your years in racquetball, do you have a favorite story?
Oh, God. I don't know. Nothing's really jumping into my mind, but really the overall story is the life I've had because of it, you know, from 16, 17 years old. Until retirement, like that was called my job. I mean, it's out of this world that I was traveling around the world doing what I would have done in a backcourt with nobody watching. You know, what I've played Sudsy, I would have played him any day for nothing, the same exact intensity. And as it turned out, I was rewarded handsomely and got to see different countries and go on private planes. And I mean, just, I'd have to pinch myself. I got to go up in an F-16 because I was considered a successful racquetball player. You know, like, there's people who've been in the Air Force all their lives that have not gone up there and deserve it way more than me. And I got to do 9.4 Gs and 7.2. I did an 17,000-foot vertical takeoff.
Whoa.
And then came out of that, like, upside down and spun around. And because of this guy, Rob DeJesus, who's in the Air Force, he met the commander, or he knew the commander of the base. It was a racquetball nut. That's probably, I guess, the single most amazing thing that ever happened to me because of racquetball is probably that. I mean, that's like incredible to be in that thing.
Yeah.
That's 90 minutes of it. And I got to fly the plane myself half of the time.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then in terms of on the court, do you have a favorite moment from your playing career?
Well, the first tournament I won was, that's a standout. I played my now good friend Scott Oliver in the finals. That was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I think 84. That's like every kid's dream, right, is to, get on the score a goal in the NHL or win a pro racquetball tournament. And, that's I just still can't even – that's amazing to me still.
Yeah.
That I was, because of the way I was born and because of the way my parents raised me, and I just did the work, and then that was the result. That was super incredible. And then I'd say becoming number one for the first time, that was another good one. And then just beating Hogan for the first time. This guy's like the legend of the sport and on national TV, CBS. And do you ever hear about that one? What's it called? Superstar Challenge?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great athletes from all sports doing these obstacle courses and bench presses. And he was on this. He was a huge, huge celebrity.
Yeah.
And to beat him for the first time, that was huge. And then just the constant wars. Those are my favorite. Even the ones now that I look back that I lost, which was, not all the time, but even if it was once, it was too often, But I've had a couple four-hour matches with Hogan. I had two with Sudsy. I think he went to the hospital after one for dehydration or whatever. And, to just go at it like that for that long with someone that great, and those battles are, I'll just never forget them. It's spectacular.
Yeah.
So fun to do.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
And so I want to transition now. We've talked a lot about your playing career. Now you are at all these racquetball tournaments as a coach.
Yeah.
What is it like being a coach, and what are the main things you've learned doing that?
Well, it is a lot of learning.
Yeah.
Because not every player goes about things the same way as me. And they might care just as much as me, but, them not showing it the way I do is hard for me to read, so learning to deal with that, and that's very challenging. That's a hard part. So, I was back and forth in that in my mind at first, well, he's different than me. That's okay. So you got to work around it and do this and do that. And then, and I feel like the desire to win and the passion should be obvious. And it is, really. Even if you're quiet or you yell and scream after you lose a point, whatever it is, it's obvious. And so rather than, always thinking that it was something I needed to adjust to, I've decided for the most part to only deal with people who I'm certain want to win, big time. You know, it's like they're not okay with losing.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they should go home and ruin their lives because they lost,
yeah,
like I did sometimes, I took it too far sometimes, but if I'm going to spend my time on it, it's not my career. I'm doing it because somebody did it for me. Dave Peck did it for me. My dad was there for me. And because they were, it made my life better. It made my life amazing. I got to do what we said, play a game for a living, travel the world, and be rewarded for it financially. So if someone of the pro level is interested in that, and they're going to do all that it takes, and I'm not just saying all that I say to do, I'd only say what to do because I know it's what works. And I'm not saying that I don't have any flexibility in those areas, in some of the areas, but some things are black and white. And, you need to show up early, you need to show up fit, and all those things, you need to eat right, you need to not do certain things, which are obvious, And when people do those things, I'm not interested in working with them. And when they, hey, all's good, no big deal, it is what it is. That's good for certain areas of life, but it's not okay if, you want to be number one and you're claiming that, and I'm going to spend my time away from my family. I just want to work with those people, and I'm not saying that, people don't care as much. It's not everything to them. That's totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I only want to spend my time preferably with people who really want what they say they want and they prove it.
Yeah.
So.
Awesome. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. We're here at the U.S. Open and there's lots of good stuff to get back to. Is there anything you'd like to plug or anything you'd like to leave our audience with?
No, I don't. Nothing I can think of. No, you ask really good questions. I hope everyone enjoys it. And yeah, nothing else from me.
Awesome, man. Where can people reach you if they'd like to get a hold of Cliff or?
Oh, I guess Facebook or cliffswain.com. There's a fine Cliff thing on there that that my web gal Jen O'Meara does. If anyone ever needs help with their game, that and by the way, I love helping a C player as much as I do a pro. If they want to do everything that they can to get better, even if just means beating a certain guy or a certain girl, you know, short term, if that's what they want to do, I love helping people like that as well. It's not only the question you asked me with the coaching, and I was kind of assuming, you know, the pro end of it, but anybody ever wants help with their game so that they enjoy it more, play more, and then they can go ahead and help friends that will then enjoy the game more and play more, I'm happy to do it.
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming on, Cliff.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dylan.
All right. So there you have it for episode 21 of the Racquetball Show podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to this one. I really loved hearing from Cliff Swain personally. And if you would like to reach out to me, you can reach me at Dylan@racquetballshow.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you.